Hi, you're listening to a special edition of the Weekly Portland Podcast. This week, I caught up with the producers and directors of Magicians, Life in the Impossible. The guilty parties are Marcy Hume and Christoph Baden. Magicians, Life in the Impossible is playing all week at Living Room Theatres. The official website is magiciansmovie.com. My name is Gregory Day. You're listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast at pdxpodcast.com. Also pdxpod.com. Blah. We begin with Marcy and then close the interview with Christoph.
Marcy, hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Now this is just, fun already.
It is fun. We're at the Ace Hotel, and we're in a little corner of the Ace Hotel. We're talking about your new movie.
Yeah, it's playing across the street.
Right.
From where we are right now. I am so excited to talk about it because we spent 5 years making it, and that makes it all the more fun when it's released because you finally get to show it to people and watch them experience it. So the film is called Magicians, and aptly titled because it is about four magicians. And
we started out wanting
to make a film about magic, but it became very much about making a living in something that's really almost impossible to make a living at. So I think it plays to a general audience, you know, and anybody who's passionate about something that, you know, they want to follow and make a living out of. And it definitely follows the sort of ups and downs of that life.
Yes, I get that. I've seen the trailer, and you've got working class magicians and then really successful magicians.
Yeah, definitely. We tried to cover the gamut without having any properly famous magicians because that felt like a different movie. We really wanted to show the struggle in some capacity. So we picked guys that were close to kind of, I guess, breaking through in some capacity, but also were, you know, at some point in their lives have been very successful, you know, raking in a lot of money for corporate gigs, making a name for themselves. One of our guys was Johnny Carson's favorite magician, but now he's towards the end of his career. And sort
Who was that?
His name is Brian Gillis.
Brian Gillis.
Yeah, so I love the part in the film when we were debating where to put in the Johnny Carson archive footage because it's such a powerful thing, you know, to see somebody 30 years ago.
Wow.
And he's doing a lot of the same routines now that he invented that nobody else does. So we really used that, you know, to kind of illustrate that journey.
And that's where a lot of documentary filmmakers run into trouble with this archive footage. I mean, it is expensive.
It is expensive. I mean, I'm not a big fan of archive unless it really illustrates an emotional point or something really important in the narrative. So we have some archive where we reveal that one of our guys, that's sort of a secondary character in the film, was actually a magician. I'm not spoiling anything, but so we use archive for that, and we use archive just a little bit to kind of show the depth of how successful some of these guys have been. But, you know, in documentary now, I think largely because of Michael Donaldson, who's a big documentary lawyer, fair use is really, really amazing. So we have footage in there from Spike TV and from the Travel Channel and a lot of stuff that we were able to use under fair use. So we didn't have to struggle too much.
Wow, really? And so this film took 5 years to make.
It did.
Did you ever think about quitting, like, right in the middle of this production, or was it a...
No, and that's exactly, you know, what you have to do, I think, with an indie documentary. I mean, we did not have financing. We did a small Kickstarter campaign for a little bit of editing money, a couple of loans. And we just knew that we would finish it. And it was I used to wake up in the middle of the night just freaking out about this movie because we had so much great footage and we'd sort of started the editing process, but I knew that we had so much work to do in making it kind of sing as a narrative, and so I would just freak out. But
Making it sing. I love that phrase.
Thanks. I don't know how else to describe it. It's like you have all this footage and you need to take people on the same emotional journey that you sort of felt or envisioned when you were making it, and that's
it is an emotional film. I got that just from 2 minutes of the trailer.
Yeah.
You really feel the struggle.
Yeah, definitely.
The highs and the lows.
You do feel the highs and the lows. And the lows can get pretty low in this movie. And, you know, somebody
asked... Yeah, to convey that kind of emotion in 2 minutes, a preview of this film was really... It struck me. I immediately wanted to talk to you after watching this trailer.
I love that. Yeah, I love our trailer, too.
It transcends the subject matter. I mean, yeah. Magicians... I mean, it adds a whole different element.
Definitely. And I think
magic.
That's the goal for me of documentaries is that you know, we inherently follow human stories. We're just built that way. We
the
don't
humanity.
Yeah,
of magic.
Definitely. I mean, you know, any documentary subject, you know, if you're doing a documentary on climate change, you know, ideally, in my mind, the best film is not a bunch of talking heads, you know, talking about the facts and figures. It's watching somebody who's on a personal journey, either trying to fight for some element of their cause or struggling with something mentally. So I think it's always best that way.
Making it personal.
When you make a documentary, for me anyway, you become sort of obsessed with your characters through the documentary lens, and you're really utterly fascinated to see what happens in their lives and kind of how things play out. You know, there's something you see in them that compels you to make them a documentary subject. And then you're kind of watching and waiting for things to happen and see how they process things and see how the themes that you saw in them actually do manifest themselves. So, yeah, there were so many moments where, you know, there's a moment that I love in the film where somebody has to move into a really small apartment for financial reasons. And
I saw that in the trailer.
Yeah,
it
yeah,
seemed
that's
really
right.
sad. And he played it off as he was really happy.
Right.
Was he really happy?
No, he wasn't. And in the rest of the film, you know, he sort of comes to grips with that a little bit.
Difficult.
Yeah, but it's always, I mean, those moments, there's one of my favorite moments is when there's a guy called John Armstrong who is just an extraordinary documentary subject, I think, and he's lying on his bed in a Motel 6. We're on a road trip doing shows, and he's, you know, kind of answering my question in a really gruff way. We had a very specific type of relationship where we kind of bickered and battled a lot over ideas and everything else, and he's kind of trying to give it to me straight about all the things he's done. But it's just this really beautiful moment where he's, you know, in this lime-colored walls of the Motel 6 kind of, you know, giving me a lot of shit, basically. And it reads really extraordinarily in the film.
Giving you a hard time?
Yeah, my relationship with him was always really intense because he, you know, I wanted to have him in the film because he has so many walls, so many kind of emotional walls that he's built. He's incredibly confident, incredibly charismatic. He's a totally extraordinary magician. I mean, really unbelievable, and has this huge repertoire and can kind of get out of any trouble in magic. But as a personality, he definitely just, you know, has found a way to kind of compensate for his geekiness. And I was bound and determined to get underneath that. So we just had it out for a lot.
Really?
But it was good for the film, ultimately. You know, I hopefully got to a different layer of him.
Do you suffer for your art?
Oh, my God. Yeah. I mean, I think we suffer in every way. We definitely suffer financially. I mean, I did.
5 years, you know, to make this. Five years of your life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I work full-time in reality television, and a huge part of the reason that I do it is because I want to have a steady paycheck so that I could make sure this documentary kept going, and it will be the same for the next film that I make.
And why, you know, magic? Why magic?
I have been in love with magic from starting about 10 years ago.
Hard not to love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's so beautiful in so many ways and has so much potential. My favorite thing about magic has always been that it illustrates or gives us the experience of joy in not knowing, and not knowing the answer, and not knowing what's going on. I think most of the time we fight to feel like we know and to have answers for things, and this is sort of this sort of explosive celebration of not knowing and being kind of in that unknown in a very visceral way. So that's my kind of favorite part of it. But there are so many other things about magic that are just so compelling and say so much about our minds.
You're in reality TV?
Are you horrified?
That's your gig?
That's my gig. That's my gig, man. But look, I'm a
big... The Bachelorette?
I don't make those shows. But I do think in reality there's a huge amount of... I think the term reality TV is really dangerous because it suggests that everything we have in unscripted TV is somehow fabricated. And I think there's such a huge spectrum of shows. And I think there are things that are, you know, narratively worked out in advance. And then there are really a lot of shows that aren't, and really compelling shows that have no producing, as it were, you know, like Intervention, for example, which is, I think, my favorite show that is technically, like, you know, at the Emmys, a reality show, doing some air quotes. But, you know, it's completely just camera people showing up.
Well, I know regular work is making you a better filmmaker. I'm sure of it. Okay, making a living as a magician. How does that work?
It's much the same, I think, as making a living as a documentarian. I think to make a living in magic, I haven't tried to make a full-time living in magic, but I've obviously seen it play out in a lot of different lives, and I think you just have to be so tenacious and so obsessed and figure out ways to make it work and just be clever and so persistent and unflagging in your your persistence and willingness to make it work.
No, I interviewed a magician who came to Portland. His name is Piff the Magic Dragon.
Yeah.
I met him in a hotel lobby, and I showed up an hour early because I wanted to make sure I knew where the venue was and we were having an ice storm. And I actually saw him, and he was practicing his magic.
Yeah.
And this was just like in the lobby, just, you know, just hanging out. Do these guys practice all the time?
I think the good ones do, definitely. I mean, there's an
element.
He's
good. He's big. He's
yeah,
got a nightly
I know.
Show.
It's great. I love it. I think the good ones do practice all the time. And I think there's another element to that, which is that when you're into magic, it kind of infiltrates your life and every level of
yes.
your life. And it just, you know, I still now sort of see magic in everything. You know, I see, that sounds really cheesy. What I mean, though, is on a mechanistic
That's
level,
a little
I
cheesy,
see.
But I'll go.
But
with
I meant,
it. Yes,
I don't mean I see magic in everything in like the hug of a child. I mean,
right.
more like
practical.
I see ways of like, oh, this is where magic could apply. And it could be, you know, in this cafe, we could have, you know, I kind of invent effects in my mind that could take place in a certain venue or with certain people. And I think it's almost like a way of seeing the world.
Well, it invokes so much emotion from you.
Yeah.
To watch a magic trick.
Yeah.
There's another local magician. His name is Reed McClintock. I tried to get him here today, but, you know, he's a busy guy.
Nice.
And the feeling I get watching this guy, he puts razor blades in his mouth and spits out a bunch of chopped up pieces of paper. I mean, I don't know why he would do that, but I love that he does it.
There's a lot of not knowing why,
the feeling,
I think.
The emotion I get, it makes me like a child.
Yeah.
Brings me back to my childhood.
But I think there's an added element from, you know, I totally understand the kind of childhood component, but then I think as an adult, it's almost infinitely more powerful because as a child, anything really is possible to you. You know, you're learning all of these bizarre
right.
things about the world. But as an adult now, we have access to answers for, you know, everything, and we're not thrown into that space very frequently, and magic just kind of throws you in there and gives you a kick in the butt and kind of sends you into this black hole of, you know, being so, so much in the unknown.
Now, these magicians, they're very smooth. Very smooth operators.
Guys. Oh,
yeah.
They are smooth. But I think, and I think that's the other element.
With their hands, even their jokes come across very smooth.
Yeah, definitely.
Practice, practice, practice.
They have to be, I mean, I think that's one of the great sort of paradoxes in magic is that a lot of people did get into it when they were kids. And there's a sort of cliche that has, you know, some truth to it where a lot of people got into it because they were maybe socially awkward as kids and they wanted, you know, magic was a kind of easy way to connect with people and have a little bit of power. Social power, but I think the really good ones take that and just hone everything about it, their social skills, their way of interacting with people. I think the best magicians can interact with each audience member in a totally different way that's kind of unique to them, and they really learn how to kind of read people and guide them through an experience. So it's a really kind of high-level
social
skill.
Audience interaction is a big part of being a magician.
Yeah, especially for the stuff that I like, which is, you know, close-up and mentalism. It's all about that, really. And I think, you know, personality and your way of interacting with people is almost the number one thing. I mean, obviously the magic has to be strong, but once your magic is strong, I think there's so many other elements to it that, you know, 90% of
comedy is a big part of
yeah,
magic too.
Yeah, and even the most serious magicians usually have some kind of jokes and levity. And, you know, David Menken, who's one of the guys in the film who in the trailer levitates the fork or the ring. I can't remember which one.
I love that. Puts
very
the ring
visual.
On him.
Yeah,
and the ring levitates, goes right back on his finger.
Yeah, and he was talking me through a routine once, and he was saying, you know, this happens. And he says, and then I say this, and they laugh, they go blind, and then I do this. And it was, I loved the way he said that. They laugh, they go blind. Because it is, it's like there are moments, you know, I mean, there are lots of misunderstandings about misdirection, but laughter and those sort of emotional moments are part of that, because they do, they sort of, you know, it's an instantaneous kind of half second checkout. And that's, you know, a time when something can happen that helps with the method of the trick.
Did you find that you didn't want to know how they did the trick? You just wanted to believe in magic?
Well, I made the choice 10 years ago to study magic. So I remember actually making that decision and being so wowed by a mentalism routine that I had to know what was going on in the psychology of the person whose mind was being read and how it was all working. So I remember thinking, okay, I got some book recommendations from a friend, and I remember thinking, okay, tomorrow there's no going back. Like, I'm going into this. And I think it's great to stay on the other side. I mean, Christoph, who I made the film with, was not interested in magic per se, although he, you know, came to love it and love our characters. But you know, he never learned anything unless it happened to show up in front of him while we were filming. And I think it was a really good dynamic, because I was obsessed with the magic being very, you know, clean and not revealing anything. And he was that kind of normal spectator eye, just following it with a camera, you know, like a normal
person.
You
need that. You need that perspective.
Yeah, definitely.
It makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I'd like to tie this to Portland. You're in Portland now. You're showing this film at Living Room Theaters.
Yes.
Or is it Living Room Theater? Theater?
I don't know. There are lots of theaters in there, so let's go with plural.
Hood to Coast. Can you tell us about this film?
Yeah, I would love to. So Christoph and I made Hood to Coast. That one took us, I don't know if it was, let's say 3 years maybe from start to finish. But it was a very different film. Christoph was kind of spearheaded fundraising efforts, and we had a budget for that film, which we did not have for Magicians. And it was a similar experience. I lived here for 9 months. We followed.
Budgets are nice.
What's that?
It's nice to have a budget.
Yeah, it's nice to have a budget. I know, you can actually, you know, we have a nice helicopter shot that opens the movie. Not for Magicians, for Hood to Coast.
So it was budgeted. It was budgeted because Hood to Coast is very popular?
Yeah, and I think, you know, Christoph and his family have a lot of ties in Portland, so it was great to kind of rally some of the community around, and he was really great with that. But yeah, and that was just a great experience. And in the same way as Magicians, I mean, we followed four teams doing the race because, you know, Christoph really wanted to do a film about that race, but we talked about the fact that, you know, again, you have to see through the eyes of someone who cares for a unique reason. And so that's what we did for Hood to Coast, is we found four different teams that had completely disparate motivations for doing the race, and kind of, you know, that was the narrative thread.
And that was a fun experience for you? You love the Northwest? You love Portland?
Oh, man. Yeah, I fantasize about living up here, but I also love LA, and I love all the work down there, but Portland is obviously growing in terms of production, and it is just such a special place.
Hello, Christoph. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me.
So you're a bit late today, and that's totally forgivable. What happened?
I'm really sorry. I'm here with my family. My daughter got really sick for the first time, so we're like, I had to stay with her and just kind of was texting Marcy. She's like, I'm coming. But I mean, I guess she was a good interviewee and had her cell phone off, so I'm glad I just have a chance to chat for 5 minutes with you.
Yes, well, I'm glad that you did show up, and yeah, it's totally forgivable. Kids have to be taken care of. You're a great father. So props to you.
Thank you. It's awesome.
I was just speaking with Marcy about this film, and I'd like to hear about your role in getting Magicians off the ground.
Yeah, so I was a little bit of the Scully in the relationship, that I didn't know anything about magic, and I was very skeptical making a film about this art form where, like, it happens to be on just very specific stages, and it's always really dark, and like secrecy is your currency, basically. So it took quite a bit of convincing for me to be part of it. So Marcy, what she just did, she just took me to the Magic Castle and showed me some amazing close-up magic. And I was like, oh, there's something right there. And then when we started meeting our first subjects we wanted to include or were kind of auditioning them, we met such interesting characters. Like the first thing we shot was like Brian on his throne. And I was like, this is such a character. We have to do this. And really, the light bulb moment for us was that we decided to make this film about magicians and not about magic.
Like, practically, what was your role?
So I personally love to shoot. I love filming. And Marcy loves to interview. So that was when we were actually together in the same room making this film. That was one of those, like, kind of understood relationship that, you know, she was very close with the characters. And me being the person who not only was kind of a magic skeptic, but really didn't know about magic, we had a really clear understanding from the beginning that I shouldn't be reading anything up or trying to figure out how the tricks were working. I wanted to be like the audience who doesn't know about magic. So she was kind of in on it, and I wasn't, and I think that really helped. So usually I was manning, you know, we both were shooting the whole time, but there was really a sense of me being kind of the surrogate for, like, the general audience and her being more like the surrogate for the magician. So when we were filming, depending on the way we cut the scene, we were kind of falling back on one footage or the other. But I just love technical stuff. So a lot of the times, there was a good chunk of time where Marcy was in London and I was in L.A., so she tried to fly out as much as possible, but there was a bunch of shoots also I had to do by myself. So that being able to, like, just, I mean, doing literally everything, doing camera and audio and manhandling, and just, like, it's, those are kind of interesting shoots, you know? But, yeah, we shot the movie together, like, 99%, but we have this really nice complementary, like, skill set, which really helps making a film like this together.
Right, she mentioned that too. Now, you live in the Northwest, am I correct?
No, I actually live in Los Angeles. My wife, who's a co-producer on the film, is actually from here. So the entire family is here, her family. Okay. So, and we come up, like, a bunch of times a year, and we made our last film here about this race called Hood to Coast. I think she talked about this, which the complete opposite of making the film, from, like, raising large amount of money beforehand and having 110 people. This one was, like, paid out of own pocket. We both worked, like, two jobs to make this film happen. She worked in reality TV, was an executive there. I do mostly direct commercials and short films for companies, and literally we earned that money and stuck it right back into this film. But yeah, it was, I mean, 98% of the movie was just the two of us. There was like three shoot days that we had a friend of ours that came on board for the third camera, but that was it.
Hood to Coast was a great experience for you.
Yes, but it was definitely one of those experiences, like, in hindsight, I'm glad we didn't have 20/20 vision on it, because I think we would have never made the film. I mean, I just remember vividly, we planned this for 6 months to shoot this event, and we had helicopters and 110 people with, like, 10 crews that are leapfrogging and, like, A-B shifting, and I just walked the night before the race into this conference room, because half of the crew had to fly in from Los Angeles. There wasn't enough people working in LA, in Portland, in film to, like, staff this. So we flew all those people in, and I walk into this conference room at the red line at the airport, and it's like, I don't know 70% of those people, and they're working for us tomorrow. It's like the weirdest experience, where it's like, wow, there's a lot of riding on this right now, and these are strangers that are recommended, but they're still strangers. And that was kind of a scary experience, and it came out great, but you know, would have known that, I don't think we would have done it, you know. With this one, I mean, this is one of the first things we said when we said we want to do another film together. It's like, let's do both from in terms of the scope of the story and also, like, crew-wise, we're going to do the complete opposite. And then she kind of approached me with magic and said this would be something really cool.
Yeah, it comes across very intimate, this film, and emotional. The trailer we were just talking about, just it hit the highs and the lows. Mm-hmm. It's playing this week at Living Room Theaters, and where from there?
So we have a really great distributor, Gravitas, who believes in getting the film out to everybody. And so they have a really comprehensive digital release strategy. So we were, I don't know if we are still, but we were on VOD on a lot of platforms like Comcast and Time Warner and whatnot. But we're also on every single digital platform. So we're on iTunes, we're on Amazon, we're on PlayStation, we're on Google Store, we're on Vudu, so you can watch us on a cell phone. Please don't, but you can. But, you know, you can just download it or just put it on your Apple TV. And it's like, there's deals going on there as cheap as 99 cents. So the more people, you know, watch it, Magician's Life and the Impossible, just Google for it, that obviously helps, you know. And it's just kind of great to get those numbers up of people just seeing the film. And then, this is a little bit of an exclusive, but we will also be in the near future on Netflix Global, which we're like super excited about, because that means there's going to be millions of people being able to see the film. And that's the, you know, well, maybe we'll have another chat at that point, but like that's coming up very much in the future. But if you have time before, just, I mean, it's literally 99 cents right now on iTunes, you know. It'll be easy to get.
Yes, saw that. Great distribution. Thanks so much, Christoph.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.
And we'll see you next Monday. My name is Gregory Day. Thanks for listening. This is pdxpodcast.com.